This morning we are on a topic that is absolutely at the forefront of your life. I am confident of that. One of the realities of life is that as surely as little kids get colds, as surely as flu will go through a house or a community, there's a reality of life that is you're going to get your feelings hurt and hurt deeply by the people. In fact, you're not going to just get your feelings hurt, you're going to get your heart torn out and ripped in two on occasions by other people. And we're going to talk this morning on this issue of what do you do when you get your heart hurt. It is a life skill you must have. I promise you, you're failing in life unless you've learned to handle in a classy Christian manner how to handle being hurt. I want to say this, that those that are paranoid and those that are most immature and those that have a warped view of life will get their feelings hurt more often than other people. But I don't care how wise you are and how whole you are and how mature you are, you're still going to get hurt. It just comes. And so how do you handle it? This morning we're going to spend some time on that. Our book that we're going to be in is the book of Philemon. Not Philippians, Philemon. Took me 3 days to find it. No, I'm joking, but Philemon is a one-page book. It's a one-page book. If you don't hit that right page, you're going to have trouble getting there. Page 1861 on mine. The book of Philemon, I would love to go with you verse by verse. This is already a sermon with a little bit of length to it, and so I can't do that. I'm also really hoping you're in Bible school class this morning. I want to say that Bible school class has real value. And to go verse by verse, I really feel badly not doing it verse by verse with you this morning. But I'm hoping you're in Bible school class that did that. Let me give you a little background. I need to do that as fast as possible. But the book of Philemon is a unique book in the New Testament. It's written by Paul to an individual, and it has to do with a particular problem. Here's the problem. A guy named Philemon, who hosts the church in his home there in Colossae, he has a runaway slave. The runaway slave, Onesimus, has ended up with Paul. And Paul has helped this guy come to Jesus Christ, the slave, and he sends this Christian back. But he writes a letter back to Philemon, who, by the way, Paul had also converted. He converted Philemon. And he sends the letter back basically asking Philemon, would you be a man of God in how you treat this slave? I probably need to take a little bit of time, at least, and visit with you slightly about slavery. Slavery is abhorrent to God. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I don't think there's any issue. No way do I want you to ever hear me say anything that is to defend slavery. But I want you to know slavery doesn't just have this big brute of a master who's got a couple of goons who carry clubs and straps and just beat everybody that have. In fact, in those days, in the average big town, one-third of the population were slaves. You can almost guarantee this. When you went to a doctor, your doctor was probably a slave. No, not to a managed healthcare system, but actually a slave to a real live person. And when you got done at the doctor's office, you paid the slave, and the slave kept the money as his income. When you sent your second grader to school, your second grader was probably taught by a slave. Her name might be Miss Smith, but she or he or whoever it was taught your child. When you went to high school, your headmaster was a very good chance your headmaster was a slave. Slavery was a system by which people lived in a community-type system. And so an owner would tend to bring in to his life this boy and treat him much like he would his own son. He'd go to education and school just like he did his own son. When you were retired from a slave, how's that for a great idea? 20 years of service, perhaps. Where'd he go? The average person, when they got done serving as a slave, retired on the same piece of property they had been a slave on. And they became a little bit of a stockholder, perhaps, even in the farm or whatever it was. Now, again, I'm not defending slavery. It's a bad system. But I also don't want you to see slavery in perhaps some ways that are not entirely right. So here's the deal. Philemon has a slave who has betrayed him. When he goes back, we don't know what Philemon is going to do. Philemon could take a club and beat him to death if he wanted to. That was legal. Philemon could brand a big F on his forehead, fugitive. Philemon could make him get out of the doctoring and dentist business and make him become a worker in the rock quarry. Paul writes this letter, and he writes to say this, "Dear Philemon, I love you and I love your family, and I love what you mean to the Lord. I'm in prison here in Rome, but Philemon, you're an encouragement to me. Philemon, I'm sending this guy Onesimus. I know that you want maybe to see him with one set of eyes. I want you to see him with a different set of eyes. This man is my heart. This man is my son. This man is our brother. And I want you to receive him back like you'd receive me." That's quite a line, by the way. Jesus used that one time. "I want you to receive people like you'd receive me." And Paul writes this letter on forgiveness. This morning, I want to get to the heart of the matter as soon as possible. It's not really easy. I know as people come in late on this service especially, it's difficult somewhat. I want you to hang in here as much as possible because this subject is really, really important. Everybody here is wrestling with it. Everybody here has somebody who's hurt you. What do you do? I think the beginning point on all forgiveness is ultimately maybe the illustration, and I would borrow this from, I saw Marion over here. Marion uses a portion of this illustration. If one of the kids were out running around in the playground out here, and they got off the playground and got over on the asphalt where there's gravel and there's that glass from that broken bottle that somebody tossed out or whatever the case may be, and one of those kids takes a headlong dive somewhere just tripping on the asphalt, you're going to end up with a pretty major cut on a kid. What's the first thing you do in healing? I mean, what do you do to heal a bad cut? Well, the first thing we all recognize you would do is this. You can't do any healing till you take out the things that don't belong. So you start picking the gravel out, the dirt out, the little glass out. You clean the wound. Ultimately, that's what this book centers on. And that's probably about the key main metaphor I would have you get, is there are things you have to remove from your thinking that are wrong. They will pop up automatically. Every time you get hurt, there's a couple of wrong things that will pop up you have to clean out, and that's where he starts. What's the first thing that pops up? What's the first lie I begin to believe when someone hurts me deeply? The answer is I begin to have a false belief about them. I will begin to dehumanize whoever they are. I mean, in the olden days, they were Randy and Julie or whoever they were, and I kind of liked them, and they're pretty good people, and they were worth $115 on my scale. But when they did that, whether they did it on purpose or accident, and everybody can tell they did it on purpose, but either way, they suddenly hit the discount table, and they become about 2 cents worth. Take them off my hands if you want to. They stop being Randy and Julie, and they start becoming them and they and it. And you suddenly devalue who the person is. We will demonize them, dehumanize them. Paul does just the opposite. When he begins to work with Philemon to help Philemon understand how to accept this runaway slave, he begins to call him my son, my heart, our brother. I have to fight, just as you do, a beginning to hang someone on the hook of scoundrel whenever they hurt us. It's not accurate. One of the most bizarre counseling sessions, afternoons I ever had was several years ago. This is a really weird afternoon. Wonderful lesson, though. Wonderful lesson. I'm in my office and have a gal who's in her late 30s come in. Her heart has been torn out by a guy that was in the church she was in back in Kentucky. It was the preacher. She, her family, and the preacher's family were friends at one point in time, had spent lots of time together, and this preacher had torn her heart out. And when she told me the stories, I don't mind telling you, my blood pressure was raising, and my sense of anger, righteous anger, was ticked, going, this is crazy. Somebody ought to knock the guy's block off. I didn't know the preacher. I'd never heard his name before. I haven't heard his name since that day. But somebody, I just could not believe the stupidity what this guy had said and done. Now, I didn't know him, but I hung him on the hook of scoundrel. I knew who he was. We've talked for maybe an hour and 15 minutes. She leaves my office. I've been a little bit long with her in the last 15 minutes or so. And so there's a guy who's been waiting for a little bit. He comes in. He was new to the congregation. I'd known him for a little while, but he's in his late 20s. He comes in, he sits down, and begins to tell me his life story. Nobody ought to grow up like this kid grew up. Nobody deserves to be mistreated like that. This kid grew up worse than any dog you'd find out here at the Humane Society. This kid was severely mistreated. This kid basically was on the streets when he was 13, 14, 15. I mean, I don't know how much he was living under cardboard, but he literally had no life of a family. And his life was rescued and saved by a man. A man who took him off the streets and loved him. A man who came in and wrapped his arms around him. A man who lived in a little cracker box of a house and cleaned out and made room for this guy to be raised there. This man had paid for his high school education. This man had paid for his college education. This man had sacrificed. And this man who did it was a preacher back in Kentucky. And it was the same name. The same man. So which one is he, scoundrel or saint? The answer is yes. The answer is yes. And what happens is when somebody hurts me, I tend to hang them over on the very kind of hook that says, worthless, not important, they've ruined it, they go in the discount pile, while there are other people who love them and are pleading for their salvation. There are people in this congregation that you have trouble with. In fact, they drive you crazy when you see them. I'm confident you worked with them one time and you can write them off. You need to know there's somebody else praying for them, begging God to send somebody in their life who'll give them other chances. Somebody loves them and raises them up. It is entirely wrong when I begin to write somebody off. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5, don't you dare call someone raka. That's the King James word for it. What? Worthless. When you begin to consider somebody worthless and having no value, you have introduced all of the foreign objects into a wound you need for it to become severely gangrene. The truth has to be seen about the individual. Part of what the issue is that everybody who is a scoundrel still has worth and value in the eyes of God and other people, and I'm wrong to write them off. Being very, very transparent with you this morning, the ministry has been a wonderful experience. I've been doing this for a little over 30 years now. I've been wonderfully treated. But like anybody, I've picked up a few scars in life. If you would push me in a corner and say, Randy, what's the hardest hurts you've ever had? Who have they come from? I could name for you an individual. To this day, I struggle with an individual who more than once, I think, has caused me to have a little blood in my shoes. I'm tempted on occasions to just say, you know, irrational, insane, crazy, just write off, angry. I'm tempted to write off mentally. And then lo and behold, but I see the individual and I see their children. Phenomenal children. Nobody can get children like that without having redeeming values in their life. And I watch what they do with wounded or weak sheep and I'm going, wow, that's really good. And I'm reminded again that I can't understand and can't explain why the wounds have come so deep and so repeated between the two of us. I can't explain that. I cannot explain that. But that's an individual for whom Christ died. And when that individual walks in heaven's gates, the Lord of grace was every bit as crucified for them as they were me. And if I ever begin to see them as less than my Heavenly Father sees them, I'm wrong. That will be my battle. What's yours? The first thing you must do with every wound is make sure you do not insert the lie that they don't matter anymore. There's a second lie. It's very similar to the first. The second lie is this, is you begin to believe a lie about yourself. I think it's the heart of the matter that Jesus does in when the disciples said, teach us how to pray, Jesus said, okay, here's how you pray. You know where I'm going with this. Our Father who art in heaven, holy is your name. Your kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we've also forgiven our debtors. And you say, wow, that language is a little obscure. What's he mean by debt and debters? Okay, here, let me clarify, he says. And at the end of the prayer, here's what he says. If you forgive men for their transgressions, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive men, then your Father will not forgive your transgressions. Or maybe Matthew chapter 18. Jesus tells a story about a man who's forgiven millions but won't forgive somebody else who's is hundreds. Jesus said, you wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you begged me to. Should you not also have had mercy on your fellow servant, even as I had mercy on you? And his Lord, moved with anger, handed him over to the tormentors until he should pay all that was owed him. So shall my heavenly Father also do to you if each of you does not forgive his brother from your heart. Do you want to know the greatest danger to this church is not whether or not we get a little snow and ice and it breaks a ceiling or a roof in somewhere. The greatest danger to this church is not whether a wind blows a tornado through some time. The greatest danger to this church is not whether or not thieves break in. The greatest danger to this church is not whether we fuss over whether you ought to use organs or guitars. The greatest danger to this church is we lose our salvation. We lose heaven. And he says clearly, you'll lose heaven if you don't forgive. Why? Because the act of forgiveness earns me merit for heaven, and the act of forgiveness suddenly gives me enough works that God says, well, okay, you can come into heaven. No, not at all. No. It's much more elementary than that. It goes down to this. If you won't forgive, then you don't understand a Redeemer and the grace you've received, and you don't trust a Christ who forgave you, and you don't trust that a Christ can forgive others, and if you don't trust a Christ who can forgive you and others, you lose your salvation because you lost your Redeemer. You lost your Redeemer. That reality is an earth-shaking reality. Everybody here struggles with it. Some of you came in cars today, husbands and wives. It was very cold in the car all the way here, and that had nothing to do with 18 degree temperature and a heater. Somebody hurt one another, and you just basically withdraw your kindness to one another. And you withdraw, you just simply say, I'm going to stand back here until you deserve to be treated better. Now you got to the front door of the church, you start saying, hi, how are you? I'm fine. How are you? I'm fine. How about you? Your wife heard you say more words in the first six steps within the building than she heard in the last day and a half. Fine, how are you? Doing good, yeah. Yeah. Because, see, we're holding out till someone deserves better treatment. There's a guy named Thomas Watson who wrote about 300 years ago. I found this in some writing by John Piper, and I want to make sure that I give the credit where I found it from John Piper. But Thomas Watson wrote something very, very profound. I hope I can make it make sense for you. When do you know you've forgiven? What does forgiveness look like? It's written in the Old English, and so I'm going to change a few words to kind of make it a little bit more palatable for us, but you'll understand it, I think. I want you to hear seven basic elements of it. We know we've forgiven when we strive against all thoughts of revenge, when we will not do our enemies mischief, but we wish well to them, when we grieve at their calamities, when we pray for them, and not the fire from heaven kind of prayer. When we seek reconciliation with them, and when we show ourselves ready on all occasions to give relief to them. Let me go down through those, because those are all seven of those are biblical. For example, resist every thought of revenge. Romans chapter 12, verse 19, never take your own revenge, beloved, but leave room for the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I'll repay, says the Lord. Romans chapter 12 says, in the life of the accused, the one who's done damage, the criminal, the one who's done bad things, there are two roles to be taken. There's the role of justice to be given to them, and there's the role of mercy. And the Lord turns and says, you, my servants, you take the role of mercy, and I, your God, will take the role of justice. Let me picture for you. You've seen it. I've seen it myself. Have you seen the courtroom? Maybe you've only saw it on TV, but have you been in the courtroom where the criminal is in front of the judge and the judge really is laboring through the sentence and what he's going to do? Have you noticed that's the role of the judge? Now, I don't know what word, and the word switches maybe a little bit, but I'm going to use the word bailiff. I've been in situations that involved a criminal, and I've seen the bailiff be so tender with the guy who is a criminal. He's taking water over to him. I was in one courtroom one time where the guy is shaking so hard, the emotions of being in that courtroom and what was taking place. And so the guy is shaking, the criminal is, and the bailiff takes his own coat off and puts it on his shoulders. In this grand scheme of things, God says, you're going to get hurt. I know you are. But here's your job. You be the bailiff of mercy. You let me be the judge of justice. Anytime I've ever reversed those, I found myself at war with God. I started off because somebody else hurt me and they were at fault. And then I thought I need to kind of get at least some sense of justice out of the deal, some sense of protection, some sense in... And God said, it's me you're now warring with, the bailiff trying to take the judge's spot. We're told, number one, you resist the thought of revenge or justice. Number two, don't seek to do the mischief. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 15, see that no one repays evil for evil. Never return force for force. Never return anger for anger. Never return heat for heat. Never return coldness for coldness. Never return words for words. Never return evil for evil. But God, they tore my world upside down. I have nowhere to stand. They tore my world from underneath me. Oh, really? You stand in the world I gave you, a world where I'll look after you, a world where I'll be your caregiver, a world where I gave you grace. You plant your feet on the sandals of the world of being a servant of mine. Number three, wish well to them. Luke chapter 6, verse 28, bless those who curse you.
Bless those who curse you. That's crazy. Isn't that like rewarding misdeeds? I mean, they mistreat you and you are kind. Why be kind and reward stupid people? I mean, that didn't make sense. Stupid people shouldn't be rewarded with kindness. You ought to give a little justice, a little cold shoulder, a little pound of flesh, a little bit of, here, how do you like that? Now, once you figured out that you don't like that, now I'll be kind.
That's not what we're told. I'm looking around for my daughter, Katie, today. I didn't get permission from this. I intended to, but I haven't seen her, so... if she doesn't like it, I'll have to have her go over this sermon on forgiveness. But anyhow, actually, I've heard Katie tell this in public twice, so it's permissible. Katie tells it starting off with a joke and kind of laughing about the episode, but it actually, for Katie, is a crystallizing moment in her childhood. It's one of the places, my little girl, it's one of the hinges that changes in her life. She tells a story. It's a simple little story. Everybody has a story like this. She and her brother were allowed to go in and watch television on either Saturday morning or whenever it was. Julie said to go in and watch television, and they could eat their breakfast in there and eat on the little TV trays. Her brother's 18 months older than she is, Troy, and so they went through the line kitchen, and then Katie gets in there, but Troy's already in there. And Katie, as she tells the story, said, he was in my chair I wanted. And he was with the TV tray I wanted. Now, Katie was not a wilting flower. I mean, I want to, you know, just kind of make that clear. I mean, she wasn't obnoxious and horrible. Don't get the wrong impression. But it was not like she just lacked any voice. So what Katie did was what little kids do. She went up to Troy and said, Troy, that's the chair I wanted. And that's the TV tray I wanted. And Troy, you're where I wanted. And that was mine. And Katie said, I'm blasting away at him. And she said, I'm mad because he's in the chair I wanted. And then she said the most humiliating thing occurred. She said, Troy, my older brother, just a little kid, said, "Oh, I'm sorry, Katie. I didn't want to be in the chair you wanted to be in, and I didn't want to have the one. I'm sorry, Katie. Here, would you sit in this chair? And Katie, would you?" And she said there wasn't an ounce of sarcasm. There wasn't an ounce of anything except just kindness. And she said, "I still blush even to this day from the inside out thinking what his kindness did that day to a sister who was shouting at him." When do I look like Jesus? When I'm singing choruses? When I'm standing here preaching? When do I look like Jesus? When I'm quoting scripture? Christ crucified on the cross with people mocking him and he's saying, "Father, forgive them, they don't know what they do." It's Stephen being stoned going, "Father, don't lay this charge against them." There is no doubt that the reason some of your homes have the tension they have is not because you have weird or odd or strange people in your house. It may be, but that's not the issue. The reason your family has the tension it has ultimately is this: somebody has refused to return good for evil and kindness when there's hurt. Number four, you grieve with their calamities. Proverbs 24, "Do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles." Wow, that's pretty profound. Number five, pray for them. I say pray for those who persecute you. Number six, seek reconciliation with them. Romans chapter 12, "If possible, live at peace with all men." Number seven, always be willing to come to their relief. Exodus 23, verse 4, "If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey wandering away, you shall surely return it to him." Just kindness. Let me mention three things forgiveness is not. Forgiveness is not the absence of grief or anger at sin. Forgiveness is not feeling good about what was bad. One of the things that you'll have to do is have tears, and you'll have anger that just really isn't within you. And you'll have to sit down with individuals and say, "This really hurts, and I really have to fight an anger that would move me to ungodliness." But it is in the arena of hurt and grief and the arena of anger that forgiveness and grace is practiced. You don't wait till the grief goes away to do it. You don't wait till the anger goes away. "Well, if the anger ever goes away, I'll go." No, no, no. No. It's the very area you have to work out of. Being Christian is not a lie where you say, "Well, oh, don't worry, that didn't bother me, I'm fine." Liar, 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 you're not fine. You're grieving. It's not a dishonesty, but it's a kindness in the middle of your honesty. Number two, forgiveness is not the absence of serious consequences with sin. That's really important. Forgiveness is not the absence of serious consequences with sin. Now, most of the things that we get hurt on have to do with feelings and emotions, and there's not a great deal of consequence on most of those. Really not. But there are some things. Hadn't happened many times in my career, but it's happened here. It has happened. Where we've been in an office and we prayed and we wept together and forgiveness took place, and when it was over, we picked up the phone and called the police. And I have seen them in handcuffs. "Well, you couldn't have forgiven or there wouldn't be handcuffs." Oh, no, 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 no. There's consequences. There's consequences. But alongside the consequences is a grace and a kindness. There are some people who ought never watch your children again. Never, ever, ever should they watch your children again. Never should they watch your children. There's a consequence to behavior. But how you treat the people who will never watch your children again, and how you look after, and even how you weep and pray for. Third thing I would say, forgiveness will look different with repentant people than unrepentant. Now, you got to forgive both. Please know, that's very, very biblical. You got to forgive both. You forgive repentant people, and you also have to forgive unrepentant people, but they will look different. With repentant people, there'll be a sweetness you can build back and a unity, and you can end up again being very, very close and hearts that are the same. With repentant people, there's a lot of things that can happen.
With unrepentant people, sometimes it's just nothing more than loving your enemy. And you could say, wow, I wish they were... I understand that, but they also play a card in this game. And their unrepentance causes my forgiveness to have at least some natural boundaries in what can be restored. But I'm still just a bailiff in the courtroom of the Lord, a dispenser of mercy while He's a dispenser of justice.
One last thing, and I know they're waiting on me at the other end, and
I wouldn't have put this in because I say it every now and then. But last night I preached this sermon, and during the invitation hymn, a family came and grabbed me, and we went in the office, and they cried, and we spent about 30 minutes, and a woman, very tender, sweet, godly lady, just kept saying, how come I keep failing at it? Why do I keep failing? I try to forgive. Why do I just keep failing? Why can't I do it? What's wrong with me? I heard her out and heard her story, and I can tell you there's nothing wrong with her. Not, in fact, she's not failing at it. I have to clarify this for you. I don't know why it is, but there are two patterns of forgiveness. I can't even predict when one will be for you and when, but there's two patterns. If you do forgiveness well, there's two possible patterns. One forgiveness is like rolling a rock up a hill, and you roll it hard, and you begin to see them as somebody who still matters to the Lord, and you begin to see yourself as somebody forgiven, and you begin to see that God is able to look after you, and you begin to roll this rock up a hill, and suddenly you get to the top of the hill, this hard, hard work, and it rolls over, and suddenly the rock's gone, and you're free, and there's no more rock, and from now on, you're in great shape with this individual, at least from your perspective. Maybe not theirs, but yours. That's wonderful forgiveness. And we like it when it occurs that way. But there's a second kind of forgiveness that sometimes is required. That's where you push the rock up a hill and you fought hard and today you labored and you wept before the Lord and you forgave today and you had such release and you felt wonderful. You've been faithful to God and you went to bed and you woke up and it's like the movie Groundhog Day. You woke up and it was right back again. It was 6 o'clock the next morning on the same day as if it never happened yesterday. And all the emotions, and it's as raw as it was yesterday, and you're just torn in two again. And you see, you say to yourself, wow, I'm humiliated. God, I thought I forgave yesterday, and now all the emotions are as raw as they were yesterday. It's like it happened all over again. God, how did I fail? And the answer from the Lord is, oh, no, you didn't fail at all. You did a great job yesterday. You just get to do it again. What? Yeah, just do it again. And day after day after day, you do what is right and faithful. And day after day, I'll tell you what the true worship of God is. It's not the person who labored hard and forgave one time. It's the person who labored hard and forgave 70 times 7 over and over and over. I used to think if they sin against you 70 times 7, then you had to keep forgiving them. That's even possible. It's this. The one sin I still had to forgive 70 times 7 because every morning it came back. Tell me what act of worship is most pleasing to God. And the answer is it's costly worship. And when the Lord stands and applauds the day you walk into heaven, there's a very good chance the very area you thought you were failing in because I could never quite get it out of my emotions and every day I had to make an act of faithfulness, the Lord will say that was your finest hour. That's when your worship meant the most. You were doing daily what was hard. And that, child, was not failure. That was forgiveness. The ground we stand on is I'm forgiven. And the ground we stand on is no man is worthless in the sight of God. And when I'm hurt, may I understand those two things.